Dear Asian Girl, for Asian girls, by Asian girls.
Hello, dear Asian Girl listeners. In this episode, we have the privilege of talking to two guests to see how their own have different perspectives regarding the memory and the remembrance of food. We will be looking at food and the memory of food through a scholarly and academic lens first, to learn more about how, as a community, and how, as individuals, you remember and hold memories of food, whether this is on a local, national, or even international scale, how this can translate or relate to our daily habits, our celebrations, etc. We will also be able to explore more about food through its artistic celebrations, and how memory can be further navigated via this creative medium, thus creating a legacy of food for the future generations to hold and cherish.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back to Dear Asian Girl, a podcast for Asian girls by Asian girls. This is Isabel Leong. I use they, she pronouns. I'm a Vietnamese Burmese high school senior based in Boston, Massachusetts. And today I'm here with...
Hi, everyone. I'm Nina. I am currently based in Singapore studying at an international school. I was born and raised in Los Angeles, though. I go by she, her pronouns. And yeah, I'm very excited to be here with Isabel.
Yeah, and today we have the privilege of interviewing Nun Tran, who's a professor at the University of Toronto, who teaches courses on gender, food, religion, and regional histories in the Indian Ocean world.
The context in which I teach this class, I teach it through the prism of food and allow them to think about different ways to approach history. So some of them include economic history and the history of colonialism. Some of them include social history. Environmental history is a big theme of the class, and also cultural history.
Every food has different significance, and we have like our community's significance with that food, but we also have our individual significance. So how would you say we place our own significance on food? And then what, like, certain countries have like their national, quote unquote, national dishes that aren't usually official and they're not written in stone, but they can be a big part of like the country's cuisine. Some people, like at least in America, we talk about how like certain foods like maybe represent certain cultures, like pho from Vietnam, like schnitzel from Germany, and certain foods from like different countries around the world. So what is the relationship between our individual experience and a collective significance of food?
Well, I think it depends on what collective you speak about. So Roland Barthes, it was a French sociologist. He talked about how each item, you know, has the significance beyond the calories it provides for you. So one of the examples we have is, I use in my class, is bread. For example, bread provides, it's supposed to be made of wheat, yeast, water, and salt. But bread in its different forms signifies positionality, class, relationship with community. So there was one moment, I grew up very poor in Houston, Texas, a family of nine kids, and across the street from my church, every week we would go to the, I think it was called Mrs. Baird's or something, and we would buy for 99 cents at the outlet store each, or I think it was three for a dollar or something, loaves of white bread made of wheat, flour, and yeast and salt. And then, you know, because that would feed for lunch during the week, the nine children, right? We could pack that for lunch with whatever was we put in leftovers. And then today, right now in the oven, I have a sourdough boule, which is cooking right now because I'm taking it to a colleague of mine who just had a baby, right? What is a sourdough boule? And its essence is also still wheat, salt, yeast, and water. But it signifies something else. It signifies my present socioeconomic and cultural position, right? It's, in lay terms, it's a bougie bread, right? It is a different, and I'm making it from college, which signifies, you know, signifies my position right now, my ability to spend the whole day because of the flexibility of my job making this bread for a colleague who's just had a child. And so in this context, then, that is, you know, that me as an individual in two different circumstances 40 years apart using the same kinds of materials, it reveals my relationship with the community. In the context of growing up in Texas, I was a child refugee, so growing up in a poor community, and my relationship with that community was, I think, one of not knowing any better, embarrassment, one, a desire to eat Western food in the sense of in the realm of white bread sandwiches rather than rice and leftover fish sauce and whatever else we had dinner. So that desire, which my father, I think for whatever through whatever miracle, he did not know any English but recognized that that was important. But that kind of desire, that was my relationship with this community as a kid whose parents did not speak English, whose parents were illiterate and uneducated. And so wanting to be a part of this, community, I mean, in the 70s and 80s in Texas, there were very few Asian Americans there. So how to fit in? And that was our way of fitting in. But we had to fit in within the confines of a very limited budget. Here, so that's an individual. And I think that changes the relationship between that food brings between individual and community changes. Here, as I, wait and bake this bread downstairs, is an expression of my care and concern for a colleague. Of course, my colleague can go buy her own sourdough bowl, right? But I do that as an expression that, to remind my colleague that there are people around that if, they find that they want to take a walk and talk about work because they're on maternity leave, that they can, and there are many of us around who can provide support, emotional or intellectual or otherwise, when they are on leave from the university. And so I think food is a way for us to express. There's no one way to express our relationship with community. There are multiple ways to do it. And I think food is just one prism through which we can do it. And I think if you use those analytical tools to think about it, you can one can, pinpoint a different number of ways. And we as individuals with agency choose to emphasize one or another way how this particular food item connects us.
Yeah, that's so awesome that almost food can almost send like messaging, quote unquote messaging to other people. And I really found interesting how giving that sourdough loaf is almost inviting your coworker, your colleague to in conversation, in, saying, I'm here for you, which I've never thought about in food before. And maybe I'll take up sourdough baking. I know a lot of people did during the pandemic, or at least a lot of my friends' parents did, and they were giving me a lot of love. So maybe now I'm thinking maybe they want to talk to me. Maybe we should have a heart to heart. So
Bring you some
yeah.
starter next week. I'll bring you some
Yeah.
starter this week in Boston.
Please, please. Yeah.
Yeah, and I really like the way you put it, how food is just one of the many prisms that we can express community. And you just described how the role of bread in your life coincided with your socioeconomic status at different points in your life, how it coincided with the different stages of life you were in. And by extension, you can even apply the same idea on a global scale where these world events that different populations undergo or that different communities experience, they influence the role and the relationship that food has with these communities. So could you share a bit on how the evolution of food coincides with world events at the time? And this is a very broad question, so feel free to hone in on whatever aspect you think most exemplifies this.
Well, certainly that's a, I think few of us are global historians. So I think what I'll do is I'll focus on one of the commodities, which you like to focus on. One of the things I focus on in my teaching is spice. Spice is defined as a highly valuable product, in relation to its weight. And so rather than focusing, typically, probably in your high school classes, you study spice and the spice trade in the context of European excursions abroad in search of an alternative route. Well, the thing is, the spices which were indigenous to the Moluccas on the far east of what is now Indonesia had long been an important kind of global commodity, and that those spices, clove, nutmeg, and mace, that were long valuable in the global networks long before Europeans became interested in the late medieval period. So in this context, Europe was a relatively new player in the 15th century. And so, the typical story you hear is in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, et cetera, et cetera. We now know that Columbus was a particularly, among even his contemporaries, was particularly heinous in the way he operated his, upper, excuse me, his ventures, how he behaved in, how he behaved in the Caribbean when he landed. So I'll just leave that aside for now and allow your audience to look that up. But long before this, these spices circulated through piecemeal from individual families. They went to the coastal lands and they were traded across kind of smaller distances, and then integrated and probably traded later on at maybe either Funan or Sriwijaya, which were very early Southeast Asian states, up and then perhaps maybe even Champa to China, to the coastal cities of China, and then there they were transmitted up through the northern communities of China, and then probably perhaps across what is known as the Silk Roads now. From Southeast Asia, they were probably transmitted across the Indian Ocean world through the smaller ports into ports in what is now southern India. And then in southern India, they were transmitted up to the Silk Roads again across the mountain passes. So this, and then across the Arabian Sea via through Muslim and Jewish traders in East Africa and in what is now known as the Middle East, to the Mediterranean, and then finally to Europe. And it's only late in the medieval period, in the late medieval period, in the 12th, 13th, and 14th centuries, when Europe becomes a major purchaser of these spices and adds a marker of status as a marker of health. And so we have that, and it's not until the early modern period, the 15th or 16th century, that European communities then go in search of an alternative route to access these very valuable commodities for their communities, to bypass the Venetian traders who had special relationships with the Ottoman Empire to import these materials. So how these spices so these spices were produced kind of on these as individual family plots over the course of the next 4 to 500 years. Spices gets transformed into a commercial commodity. They're produced as a commercial commodity. This means essentially, rather than family plots, they are produced on larger scale plots, and this moves families outside of their communities, outside of their villages, because in order to be efficient and to sell at a certain level, they would move out of their communities, live alongside the groves. Pepper being the primary example of a crop which changed this in Southeast Asia, and families would live beside the groves and then produce these crops, which would then be traded on an international scale, and these would be subject to a global demand and the pricing system. What happens though, for example, in the case of pepper as a spice, is that in order to grow pepper in Southeast Asia, the forests have to be cut down. The forests have to be cut down. This is, this contributes directly to kind of the long-term effects on the global environment. Forests have to be cut down, and as they're cut down, the land has to be prepared for pepper growing. Whether it's pepper or coffee, I'm going to use pepper as this example. Whereas it's prepared for that, Nothing else can be grown there. Rice can't be grown there. So what this means is these communities then turn away from producing the product which for generations has provided their basic caloric needs. And they produce a product for a global market, which is kind of subject to the kind of fluctuations of the global market. What happened when there is a sudden decrease in the demand for pepper? People can't just turn around and look at the rice paddies and harvest the rice to eat. They're dependent on importing the rice. The cost of rice probably then rises, and that creates a kind of a crisis within individual communities. These are crises which is well documented from the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, but that's just one example. We could use another commodity such as coffee as a different example. But when these kind of food items change the way families, just in terms of living patterns, relationships with the communities. I'll give you another example, which maybe perhaps is a more positive example. It begins as a sad story. Kampot is a region in Cambodia which grows a very fragrant pepper. No, are three kinds of pepper known as the Kampot pepper. There's white, black, and red pepper. And for many years, this was an area which grew these very fine peppers. During the Khmer Rouge between 1975 and 1979, the government which the communist aligned government which ended up rounding up and displacing community members, first rounding up and essentially executing first anybody who had who was educated, who knew foreign languages, who was possibly tainted by an interaction with foreign communities. This meant Khmers living abroad who had come home, etc. So this policy and extended to anybody who interacted with them. It also included a forced migration of individuals into these agricultural zones where they would have to work. The Khmer Rouge required them to work. And the out migration out of Kampot, the region, led to a near decimation of the Kampot growing pepper area. Kampot pepper growing areas in Cambodia. But for the genius and prescience of two brothers whose family had been growing Kampot pepper for generations, and they, through some miracle, were able to save seedlings of the Kampot plant. And after what is estimated that between 20 and 30% of that population of Cambodia was killed during this regime, as the survivors began to trickle back into the communities, these brothers were able to bring back the seedlings or the seeds that they had saved. And now Kampot peppers, once again, a crop that is grown in Cambodia in these communities. And there's an effort to kind of to regenerate and rebuild this community and this artisanal pepper, the growing of this artisanal pepper for to invest back into the community itself.
That's so
So,
beautiful.
there are various examples, but it changed. This is why historical contingency is so important to, and that's why it's so dangerous just to equate one food item to an entire culture. When accidents in history, historical contingencies can change the way a food item is produced and what it means to a community. The irony, of course, is that it's so difficult and hard to grow. And of course, we want to pay growers well to grow Kampot pepper. The irony and the sadness, of course, is that Cambodians living inside Cambodia and abroad can't afford Kampot pepper. So,
And where do you see that? Obviously, that impact is very visible, but Do you see a way to alleviate that, or is that cultural kind of preservation something that is almost comes at that cost?
Well, I'm not a policymaker. So I think what I tell my students is that we, as individuals who are not policymakers, we can either make our preferences known, or we can choose how we consume and how we behave. And so what I hope for my students is then the next time they travel to Cambodia or another community, they comport themselves in a way that is respectful within these communities. Sometimes it means something as simple as not understanding and not haggling. That, I mean, for example, when I go to Southeast Asia or other communities, a lot of travelers get all caught up in what is the right price to pay for something in X, Y, and Z market. My advice to students is the right price is the price you can pay without hardship to yourself. Otherwise, it doesn't matter. I mean, I think that if you approach that as a guiding principle, then it allows you a flexibility to interact respectfully with people around you. Sometimes when I go to Southeast Asia with students, there's been a difficulty. Students find it, there's a difficulty, and I can understand, having been a poor student myself, with financial obligations. But I always tell them that the obligation within your own community in Canada is, for example, you provide something in terms of a tip a little bit more to signify your appreciation. And so at the very least, you do that when you're traveling as a guest in another community, knowing that it means so much more to the individuals you're interacting with whom you're interacting than to yourself. And so that's all we can control. I mean, we can't control the global market. That also means, paying attention to how you spend your money. I grew up, because I grew up in Houston, eating a lot of shrimp. To go back to the example of shrimp, we don't really eat shrimp in our family anymore, unless it's wild shrimp because of the way in which it's produced. And so I think if you understand that it is your desire and your demand to have these products at such low prices, which is what produces these inequities for people. I don't know. My hope is that that will change in terms of the global processes. Maybe it won't, but at the very least, you understand that you didn't contribute to it.
Yeah. And this is kind of a question kind of veering off of this topic a little bit, but how do you see colonization affecting like the celebratory traditions of many cultures, such as in Vietnam during the French colonial period? French settlers altered the value of food items through their introduction of Western food, such as bread, dairy, and you mentioned coffee earlier. And while several of these foods are now kind of synonymous with Vietnamese culture and cuisine, the social value placed on eating these certain foods stem from the French colonialism. So, kind of back to the question, how do you think colonialism has affected or not affected these traditions slash these significant foods of many cultures?
Well, I think we just have to be careful, because to use the example of Vietnam, what we call Vietnam is a very modern state. It didn't really it wasn't really settled by people of the King, who are the city people, now known in shorthand as the Vietnamese, until very late. And so if you use the example here of Vietnam and the city of Saigon in the south, this was traditionally Khmer land. And so in this context, we should acknowledge and understand how Vietnamese settlers have disenfranchised and displaced individuals of different indigenous individuals of those community indigenous communities as well. In the context of French colonial order, French colonialism. Of course, as a historian, I never, and in related to this thing, I don't think of culture as a static phenomenon, but it's constantly changing and being reconstituted. So in this context, bread in Vietnam, first of all, in the I'm not sure it hurts anybody in the context that a lot of people recognize banh mi as a quote unquote Vietnamese food. I would be reluctant to suggest that this is necessarily a reflective of some kind of centralized Vietnamese culture. But if somebody were to recognize, to think of banh mi as indicative of a contemporary Vietnamese food, I think that would be all right. I'm writing a book right now on the history of Saigon. And in fact, the book is a cultural history and it looks at the multi-ethnic histories of the city itself. And each of the chapters, I talk about a food item. And in this context, I talk about banh mi as reflective of Saigon, the city, both in its multicultural dimensions and how it had always represented kind of a future and a promise, in the sense how banh mi in its various forms is ubiquitous in the town itself. How has it changed? We don't know, because of course for many years wheat was imported to Vietnam. I don't think that bread as an item was, and I would have to think and do the research to know, but bread as an item was ne never constituted as such a huge dimension of the purchasing power of everyday Vietnamese. Still today, for people in rural areas, it is a luxury item. So one dynamic of it, one could say, is that at the expense when individuals started importing bread makers, ovens and bread makers in the early 20th century, I believe it was the 1930s was the first bread machine, industrial machine that was imported to Saigon in that era. I believe it was the 1930s, but I could be mistaken. It's indicative of a broader problem, which was that the French colonial authorities extracted tax in terms of money, in kind, in terms of labor from individuals, and they did not invest back into indigenous industry. And so it's indicative of a broader problem. So, for example, the colonial authorities probably would have provided incentives for the businesses which, drew upon, for example, bought the bread machine and the baking products, because that facilitated a Western part of the economy. And so, in this instance, the taxes were extracted from everyday people, and the benefits of that were not reinvested into everyday people, but rather reinvested in the Western dimension of the economy, whether it was in the bakeries which catered to French coolong or a new Vietnamese bourgeois class. But it ignored the vast majority of the Vietnamese population and did not support them. A different example would be alcohol, that there was the state had a near monopoly on the sale of alcohol, and for a while prohibited individuals and families from making their own alcohol or moonshine, and required that they buy them from the state. Of course, French alcohol was not very good, French compared to the rice wine that individuals made in their homes. And so this was detrimental because it required, and first of all, an outlay, a different kind of tax, an outlay of funds from individual families for a product which was deemed as superior by the French state because it conformed to the processes which the French said were scientific and medically sound, and that hurt indigenous business ventures. It also ultimately kind of was a different kind of tax on the population. Of course, that was the French, it was incredibly unsuccessful for the French. And Vietnamese began and initiated anti-alcohol monopoly protests because, of course, it was not acceptable to everyday Vietnamese that they had to drink this kind of bad alcohol and to buy it from the state at a higher price than they would have to buy from individual communities. So those are just two examples of one which it probably changed the taste over time. But I think what's much more important is rather than thinking about it a wholesale as some kind of takeover of cultural practice, to think of culture as dynamic and always changing, and to think of what is the root of it isn't that bread was introduced to Vietnam, it's that the French refused to reinvest the proceeds from their taxation of everyday people, people living at the margins of survival, into industries which would be helpful to everyday people in Vietnam.
Yeah, you described how that monopoly that was created, sorry, the monopoly that was created in the alcohol market, it deprived families of the pleasure to make their own drinks. So they merely had to drink the French state alcohol, which you described to be not as pleasurable or enjoyable for these people. And so I'm curious about this is more on the celebratory side of food and other commodities. I'm curious, what is the essence of celebrating food that creates like fond memories, and how does like food play a role in this celebration, or just ingesting comfort food together, or ingesting food or drinks that you know and love and are familiar with culturally?
I would be reluctant to suggest that I know any essence, much less, so I wouldn't necessarily call it an essence, but I think I would ask you to think that food touches a wide variety of senses for you. And so it can evoke memory in celebratory practices. Kind of memory that maybe in the past you necessarily did not enjoy, but now it brings you comfort. So one of the examples I use here is for the Lunar New Year, there's a Vietnamese Tết cake. It's a square item in northern Vietnam, and it's a rounded item in the south. It's made of glutinous rice, boiled for a long time with a mung bean center, sometimes with pork inside it, or vegetarian. I don't know how much I enjoyed it as a kid. It's, I have, it was just a part of what we did. Houston, Texas, you couldn't buy that then in the 70s and 80s. And now every Lunar New Year, I order it. I once made it, but it takes an incredible amount of time. I order it from the local, the lady who makes the tofu. I think her sister-in-law makes it. And we eat it. I eat it, but on the eve of Tết, we cut it out and we put it out, and I pickle some mustard greens and stuff. We put it out for my father's soul and my grandmother's soul to return to have it. And so it evokes for me and for my kids who never knew my father a memory. Memory, my father was handicapped. And so my memories of childhood are that around Lunar New Year, in the middle of the night, I would see him sitting in the kitchen without his prosthetic foot and packing these cakes. And so for me, other than the taste of the food itself, the individual item, it evokes memories, sacrifices, and experiences that when I was 6, 7, 10, or 11, was too young or immature to understand. And so when I serve these foods to my children and to myself, it's a way of connecting my descendants to my ancestors in this, through this simple item of the food. They can taste it. And so for whatever reason, my kids, they like the taste of these Tết cakes. In a way, and they express a desire for it every Lunar New Year, that they know that it's time to come. Have you ordered the cakes yet? And so we do that every year. And so I don't know if it's they actually they crave the taste or not, but they ask for it, and they know that it kind of when I go and I order it, that it begins a series of events which allow them to have a connection to a grandfather and a part of the past that they don't have. And they live in Toronto. They live in a community, right? They live in a specific community. They have their daily kind of exercises. So it evokes this kind of memory and an attachment to a side of the family that is particular, and these practices which are particular. So I think food has that potential to do so. I don't know if it's an essence, but it's those kinds of things which I think food items in celebratory circumstances allow us to attach whatever meanings we want out of it. In this meaning, I want my kids to have some kind of sense of the sacrifices the grandfather made without my having to detail it, in narrative form.
That was so beautiful. Thank you so much for that. I think that like truly is what the essence, and we said this, although the sourdough example is not exactly a parallel example, but the messaging and what food brings up when you smell it, when you think about it, and how it brings you back to a time or reminds you of someone who lived. I always think about Lunar New Year and how my grandmother makes a whole feast, and it's not even about the food, it's about like the table that she serves it on. And I think about how that table, she's had that table since she immigrated to America, and every year that table comes out only for that one day. And I just always think about that before I go to her house, and I'm like, oh, today that special table is going to come out. There's certain flowers that come out, there's certain fruits on the table. And when I see those foods or flowers like in the supermarket, I am brought back to that. So thank you so much for. Today we have Saraswati TK, who is an artist who paints hyper-realistic still life paintings of traditional Indian food.
I'm a self-taught artist, and I started painting by seeing all the videos online. When I used to go and visit the exhibitions and view the paintings of other artists, I used to get inclined towards still life paintings. And I had participated in a couple of exhibitions, namely, like I started from Affordable Art Fair Singapore. I needed in my own identity. So when I got a chance to view the hyperrealistic food paintings by Tejas Parnassi and Mary Ellen Johnson, I was so curious to know, like, how do my own cuisine or my own food looks in the form of paintings? This hyperrealistic form of art is very even though you view these subjects or this all are a part of your everyday life, but when you see it like a life size or the intricate details of the same subject, which we neglected, even though we are eating the same food every day, we don't see all those intricate details in the food that just really brings in like so many textures, surfaces, and the colors in it. So idli is something very common, like it's a very staple food in the morning. So when I grew up, I used to hate that breakfast because I had to eat it every day. But when you think what you have to start, that's what I didn't never think that I was so engrossed into that subject or into that food, especially. Even though I've grown up and I have kids and I can't make my own idli as soft as what my parents have done or my grandparents have done. So this is like a tribute in the form of, even though I can't prepare it in that same way, I just thought like it could be a tribute to which I had grown up. So that's how I started with idli as my first painting. It brings back memories. So when you see food, you have a kind of emotion associated with it. It could be your sad memory or a lovable memory or a memory of a place or memory of a person or something that you love to do or love to eat. So it always brings out some kind of emotions out of you.
When you mentioned that your relatives and I guess past generations have made such memorable food and it's so hard to replicate it, I think I relate to that as well, because on every Sunday, so today actually, I visit my grandmother and we cook together all the time. And then I try to make the food at home and I'm like, oh my gosh, it doesn't taste the same. And I always think about, I'm following the exact same thing, like same ingredients, maybe different measurements by a little bit. But I think it's also the emotional aspect of it that makes it taste even better.
Yes, because it's the same idli and you get it in different tastes everywhere around the world. You don't get the same taste or you don't get the same texture. So that's another beauty of this subject.
How do you think this food, and I know you moved from Singapore to the US, how has that shaped your identity as an individual, but also as an artist?
Yeah, when we travel through, we know how the same thing, the same culture or the same food is being represented in various things. But the authenticity always comes from where you are born. So I felt this could be one of the realistic forms that you can represent it to everybody. That this is how I started eating when I was small or when I was like, no, it's original form. I know now you have various types of idlis, various forms coming out of the same traditional recipes. So I just wanted to make the old recipes that the old original form of the food as such.
Yeah, and having the opportunity to make your own original form and an original rendition of this food. What was it like to be able to have your first solo exhibition? Was it I believe it was Botan in Manhattan. What was it like to be able to see that this accomplishment come to life and showcase your works in this manner?
I mean, I was so happy to accomplish that. I wanted to represent this food in the form of art, and whoever had visited, they felt very happy. They were able to relate to that they had this food in some place, and then they have never seen, nobody has seen Indian food in the form of art. So that was the form of joy and expression that everybody has expressed. And this is a life-size painting, so people could see even every intricate details, because each of my paintings takes 3 months to paint. So for example, the papad has almost 10,000 circles. Like, it has so many circles, so everybody was able to view, like, enjoy each and every bit of the painting, and they could relate it to, oh, this is what I had released it in this way. So it was really nice.
Feels significant how much effort and time is put into like the curation of these paintings. Like it's very delicate. Like the way that you handle papad as a food, it has to be so delicate, otherwise it's gonna break, gonna crack, it's gonna fall over the place, all the crumbs. So I feel like it's very representative even of the experience of eating it.
You make the food and then take the pictures of it. And could you talk a little bit more about how do you select which foods you make? Because there's so many that you could.
Cooking is another form of art, and I try to bring the combine these two forms of art. And I prepare, for example, if I have to start with an idli painting, I just prepare like 50 idlis so that each and everything comes in a good shape, or it's fluffy and it has the same kind of texture. And then I try to photograph it like 100, 200 pictures, and then I try to bring them to 50 and then to 10, and then finally one single picture comes to life. So each and every, even though even I'm making it, it's not going to be the same kind. So it's very difficult to bring that kind of like an artistic thing to bring it. So cooking, then photographing, and then painting. So it is a very long process, and because cooking is one form of art, photography is another form of art, and painting is another form of art. So I really feel happy to combine, even though the process is a very long process.
And how do you think that how there's such diversity and so much variety in all these different foods, how do you think that portraying all these different dishes helps shape your own identity and your own relationship with Indian food, especially as you moved from Singapore, where there's a significant Indian population, whereas in New Jersey, I believe in some parts there is some Indian population that you can connect to and feel somewhat at home in, but it's still a very big cultural difference. So how do you think having these food paintings as well as the ability to cook, how do you feel like that being able to carry that with you helps shape your identity?
Yeah, because I wanted to, when I'm giving a message, I also thought about like the people should know everybody because I'm putting it on a global dais. So the people need to relate everything. So I first took a few paintings that everybody could relate to, like samosa, garlic naan, dosa, mango lassi. But I, in that, in the same language, I also tried to put other food too, because the name of the exhibition was Bhojan. Bhojan means a complete meal. So I tried to bring one from south, one from north, and also like one like a starter, one like a main food, like a rice dal tadka, one like a dessert, and one like you know, drink. So I tried to balance everything. So but in and at the same time, I also was conscious that like some dishes should be little common where people could be able to relate to. So that's how I came to this 12 paintings, like these 12 dishes. Yeah, because I've been in Singapore, I was in Dubai. So I've seen like all parts, like from southern or from northern side or from east, west. So I try to put everything, try to represent one dish from every place and then bring it. And I wanted to put it on a global dais.
That global lens or global perspective gives so much meaning to the whole work. I'm wondering, what dishes have you portrayed carry the most social significance?
I think each and every food carries a different significance. For example, that's where I differentiated the painting with when there is a tadka, like with the curry leaves or something, to make sure that it belongs to South. And if it is like not without a tadka or like curry leaves, it doesn't belong to the South. So I just made a fine line of variations in every food so that people could be able to relate a bit to it belongs to the Southern, it belongs North. So that's how was the thing significance given.
And deciding whether or not to include these curry leaves, do you feel as if there's almost like a, not a pressure, but like a responsibility in terms of depicting these dishes so that you can portray them accurately and authentically for the people who eat these dishes, for whom it's a very important part of their cultural history?
I felt that Indian food is just not about just having food. It has a great science behind it. We have a specific reason to add jeera into our food. We have a specific reason to add the curry leaves into the food. It is like this idli batter and dosa batter had been from like 5th century BC. There's a big history behind each and every recipe. It's been in the cultural scriptures and everything from so long. So I even in my website, I used to try to give a 2-3 sentences about like when was it originated from. It has a long history behind it. I feel our food has long history and science both combined together. So that's where if you see my paintings, the jeera is also a little big. So if someone comes and sees, I just wanted them to know that jeera is added into our food for various reasons, like for digestion, not just for aroma. It has so many great things behind it. So that's why I wanted to make even our Indian food also to be a part of art history or the museum culture, so that way people could understand it, even not now, even in the future, for our generations also.
Just going to say, I think that's a beautiful legacy that you're creating for yourself.
Yeah, it makes me think about my mother's Vietnamese, and she hasn't been back to Vietnam since she immigrated to the U.S. And I, on your website, it says, you know, having lived outside of India for several years, food is a valuable way to connect to your roots. And immigrants all over the world rely on food from their native countries to maintain their connection to their origins. It just reminds me of how every week my mother tries to teach me a recipe, or when we'll have like a dinner, she'll make sure to like talk about her memories and the story she has attached to the food. And it almost feels like I'm there with her and she's taking me back to Vietnam with her. And it's such a beautiful way that like I've learned about my family's history through food, especially because my mom, she hasn't been back, so she doesn't really know what her old home looks like, but she knows that, you know, she can vicariously live through these old memories. So.
Yeah, food is very important to connect to your roots and to understand their emotions, and it's a very lovely subject.
In celebrating traditional holidays or holidays that my mom and my grandmother invite me to celebrate, how do you see the second generation immigrants celebrating these holidays, and how will that affect the evolution of these celebrations for years to come? Like, I know at least for me, I feel like these celebrations, I've always just felt obligated to go to them, but I'm not sure if I would host them when I'm older. I feel like I would because I have it reminds me of my family. But what do you think is going to be the future of these holidays for second generation immigrants and their kids onward?
Well, I don't know. I'm not a soothsayer. So what I imagine and I hope is that with the attention globally to food and how that can evoke memories and practices, that people will take parts that they, as people have in centuries past, take parts of the teachings, whatever teachings they are in celebrations, and make it their own and make it relevant to their particular lifestyle. I mean, other than my father making those cakes and us eating them, we didn't really have celebrations. We were poor and we're Catholic, and my parents are of the pre-Vatican II era, so there was no such thing as images of their ancestors or inviting the ancestors to come home to eat, because that was taboo before Vatican II, and they're of a generation that was pre-Vatican II. And, so the practices that I have with my kids are just practices that I thought would make sense to them. We have my grandmother's picture there, my mother's mother, my father's picture there, because, I mean, they knew my grandmother, but these are people who kind of were important to me, and I want them to have a connection to these individuals, even if they could not, because they can't really talk to my mother, and to have a kind of attachment to this side of the family. I'm sure my siblings have this celebration differently. I don't have any family in Toronto, so I invite my friends over with their kids, and I tell all of them to, bring money, and I'll provide the envelopes, and then they can stuff the envelopes and give it out to kids. And so it's also a community building effort. And well, pre-COVID, we used to have these big parties, and the kids would leave the parties with maybe like 10 to 20 bucks. So kids would have, when they were young, it was kind of cool to show up to a party and leave with 10 or 20 bucks. And it was a part of community building, and everybody knew that this was going to happen around that time. So I think what I would hope is, like, future generations, whether it's your generation or your children's generation, you have access to much more information and knowledge than we ever did. I'm of the generation of the pre-internet generation, right? I mean, the internet had just become a thing when I was in university. And so my hope is that moving forward, that people would pick and choose what makes sense for them, and to make meaning, whether it's with their ancestors, or whether it's with the future, or whether it's the community. Not all of us have relationships or regrets of relationships past with our ancestors, and not all of us have communities we can tell, with whom we can interact. But some of us do, and so we pick and choose the families we make and the practices we want, and make meaning of it. As today in Myanmar post-coup, communities in Myanmar have to learn how to make meaning now pretty much dislocated and siphoned off from the global community and their family and friends. And so, they have to figure out how to make meaning for their descendants in the face of incredibly difficult circumstances. And I would hope that, in the future, the descendants of the young people who are in the streets right now will remember and figure out how to commemorate and mark the ways in which their parents, especially young women in the streets of Myanmar, have protested the violent coup from 2021 and the repression. So I think I like to think of this as both individual and collective strategies of survival. And sometimes survival is being able to recall a collective or individual memory to make us go on for another day. This is what the Burmese writer Matita talks about when she talks about how Buddha's teaching allowed her to survive in the prisons of in Myanmar when she was in prison for, I think it was something like 7 or 8 years for her political activities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you so much for that. And we've had such a fruitful conversation with you this past hour. And I want to open the floor for any final messages that you have for our audience. And yeah.
Oh, I don't know. I don't know if I have any final messages for audiences. First, I think I would thank you for the opportunity to speak with you. It's been a pleasure and an honor to talk with you. One of my favorite things about teaching in the university is actually, and when I was in administration, was meeting high school students, younger people who were thinking about university and seeing the possibilities. I want to thank you for the project you have been working on, apparently for many years. I think it's an inspiration to people who listen to the product, and I hope that let me know what I can do to help publicize it, because I wish that as a 15-year-old or 16-year-old in Houston, Texas, in the 1980s and early 90s, you know, when I spoke about the social dislocation, being in this, you know, not very diverse community, that I had something like your podcast to listen to and to think that I was not alone in this world. So I think to end, I would just like to commend you on your project and to thank you for having me join you today.
Yeah, thank you so much for being here. We actually have, I think, three people on our podcast team from Houston, Texas. So it's pretty interesting to see that. But yeah, Nana, do you have any last thoughts?
No, just I think these last few moments where we just like talk about how evocative food is, it's been very powerful and very emotionally evocative. And I think thank you so much again for your kind words of how like this project that we're doing and everything. We really appreciate it. The honor truly is ours to be able to talk to someone so knowledgeable about the subject and be able to spread or shed some light on such a washed over topic of food. Sometimes I think recently in the years, the topic of food and being mindful about your eating habits, it's been very environmentally focused. It's been very like focused on the impact it has on ecosystems. And we've talked about this a bit in this season as well, how there's a lot of greenwashing as well that businesses may, you know, partake in order to advertise their food. But I think another aspect to be mindful and reflective on our eating habits is also from a cultural perspective. So I just want to thank you for being able to bring attention to that.
Yeah, so that concludes the interview. I hope that your sourdough goes well. I'm still thinking about your sourdough, if you can't tell.
Want more of Dear Asian Girl? You can find us everywhere on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Anchor. We're on everything. Can't get enough? Subscribe, follow, rate, review to get all the updates on the latest at DAG. Let us know your feedback and what we can do to improve. We also can be found on Instagram. Follow us at Dear Asian Girl to receive updates about our latest episodes and fun facts about the host. We'd love for you to reach out. DAG, Dear Asian Girl, a podcast dedicated to share the stories of Asian girls everywhere. For the Asian girl, by the Asian girl.